You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Stew.
Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
I'm not pens. Being sniffy.
I think I you mean, are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
you're the negative value in the piece. Don't think about it. You're there. You're going to play Hitler. You got to give it everything you've got. You got to be the best Hitler you can be.
Here's Johnny.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
The New Zealand film director Taika Waititi is best known for his small and singular drama comedy crossbreeds, like Eagle vs. Shark, about two very socially awkward misfits.
Do you want a kiss?
Yep.
On the lips, though?
Yep.
Okay.
And the Sundance hit from last year, Hunt for the Wilder People, about a very young juvenile delinquent and a backwoods curmudgeon.
Why would I need to read a map? I already told you I know where I am. Reading's stupid anyway.
So, what is his next film about? The Asgardian God of Thunder, naturally.
I need to stop her here and now.
To prevent Ragnarok, the end of everything.
Waititi is the director of Thor Ragnarok, which is the latest blockbuster in the Marvel superhero series. While it has all the obligatory computer-generated action scenes and movie stars and cosmic existential stakes, it is also a very smart, funny, character-based comedy. Taika Waititi is with me here now to talk about this new movie and the movies that inspired it. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why did Marvel and Disney or whichever say, yeah, this is our guy. This guy's made these little movies in New Zealand.
That's a great question. I've been asking myself for that for a couple of years. I think what they wanted was a certain tone. They actually had watched What We Do in the Shadows, my mockumentary about vampires.
Stu took it pretty well. He's definitely my best mate. And I'm not going to eat him. Vampire mates don't eat human mates. And no matter how much I wanted to eat him, I would never eat him because he's my mate. Hey, Stu.
Yeah.
And then they watched Boy.
Which is your movie from 2007 about this 11-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You got a girlfriend.
There's this girl that really likes me a lot. But I don't know if I want to, you know, get involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't get her pregnant, that's all. It's the number one rule.
And it was actually Boy that made them think that, you know, I might be able to handle not only the comedy elements that they were looking for, but also the stuff that needed some weight to it.
And so they give you the gig, and then did you panic at all? You don't seem, at least sitting here today, like a very panic-prone person.
I had a little reticence because I thought, oh, well, yeah, is this, they've got a really successful track record of, you know, 15 or 16 successful films. Am I going to be the one to, you know, to ruin that record? Am I, you know, is this the one?
Yeah. This comedy superhero movie is practically a new genre. And you must have thought, and I wonder, because you're the first expert I've talked to about this, is why these comic book-based movies are now becoming comic.
Because the world is a very depressing place, and we need some true escapism. I think tonally, you know, we're kind of going through these phases, aren't
right,
we?
Right.
Men in Black. Now, we kind of feel like we can handle it. Yeah. Men in Black was amazing.
James Bond movies, which may have invented
Roger Moore.
Right?
All of Roger Moore's stuff. Exactly. Like, really funny.
He suggests the trade. The egg for your life.
Well, I'd heard the price of eggs was going up, but isn't that a little high?
And yeah, we'll go back to the kind of Dark Knight gritty sort of, you know.
Yeah. Now we're living the Dark Knight land.
So exactly.
We need Men in Black.
We don't need to be reminded of that when we go to the movies.
Yeah. The dialogue in this film feels, in addition to being actually funny, actually making me laugh out loud, which, ask my family, I seldom do, feels loose and naturalistic, and which led me to the question of how much of this is ad-libbed here and there on set?
Well, a lot of it is ad-libbed. We had a script written by Eric Pearson. What I tend to do with scripts, unless I've written them, is just take them as more of a suggestion of what to
do. So you have contempt for writers unless you're the writer.
Exactly. So we'd get to set. Well, also, my problem with a lot of studio films, a lot of Hollywood films, is when you hear a joke in these films, they're like some sort of, you know, witty one-liner, a little quip. A little quip. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And you know that they wrote that 7 or 8 months before they shot it, and it was all planned, and it's like, oh, can't wait to shoot this gag. And my style is to get to work and say, how can we take what's on the page and make it 20 times better? Based on what props we have here, who the actors are, because I didn't know that these actors were going to be cast when we were writing. And yeah, and just basically try and find, you're only on set in that moment once, and you only have that one chance, that one day or that one moment to get the best material out of your actors and off the page. You can never just settle for the written word.
One of the best ad-libs happens when Thor is forced to engage in gladiatorial combat and he finds out that his opponent is the Hulk, his long-lost friend.
That was actually given to us, and it was offered up by a Make-A-Wish kid who'd come to visit set, and you know, little kid who was hanging out on set, and in between takes, you know, Chris would go over and say hi to him and hang out. We were about to start a new take, and he said, hey, the Hulk's about to smash through this door. Why don't you say, yeah, we know each other. He's a friend from work.
I give you your incredible...
Yes! We know each other. He's a friend from work.
Turned out to be the best line in the movie.
It's a good line.
And it's on T-shirts
now. And this is
now,
really like a little kid?
A little kid, yeah.
Any others you recall?
Well, most of my character's lines are ad-libbed.
And your character is this...
this rock monster.
Doofus rock monster called Korg.
Korg. Like the piano / synthesizer. Korg.
Here's a clip of Korg with Thor, played by Chris Hemsworth.
You know, I really wish I had my hammer.
Hammer?
Quite unique. It was made from this special metal from the heart of a dying star. And when I spun it really, really fast, it gave me the ability to fly.
You rode a hammer?
No, I didn't ride the hammer.
The hammer rode you on your back?
No. I used to spin it really fast, and it would pull me off the...
Oh, my God. The hammer pulled you off?
The ground. It would pull me off the ground, up into the air, and I would fly. Every time I threw it, it would always come back to me.
Sounds like you had a pretty special and intimate relationship with this hammer, and that losing it was almost comparable to losing a loved one.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Now, I that's one of the places I laughed out loud, because it went on and on and on. It wasn't propelling the plot.
No.
It was doing nothing but being funny.
That is most of my character's dialogue, is doing nothing. It's not propelling anything. I'd go so far as to say my character may even be the most pointless part of the film. But the most enjoyable, maybe. I think that's why this film is so different humor-wise.
Yeah.
You know, you have these conversations that go on, and you can tell they weren't planned because superheroes aren't supposed to talk like
yes.
this. They're not supposed to have long conversations about feelings and emotions while sitting on the bed after an argument. I'm referring to Thor and Hulk in that little scene where
right.
you know, they're apologizing to each other.
We're the same, you and I. Just a couple of hot-headed fools.
Yeah, same. Hulk like fire, Thor like water.
Well, kind of both like fire.
But Hulk like raging fire, Thor like smoldering fire.
That scene doesn't even need to be. I mean, it's like
no,
but it's texture and it's flavor,
yeah.
and actually it endears you to the characters more.
Absolutely, you said that Thor Ragnarok is with Nolan I in space. With Nolan I is this great 1987 British film directed by Bruce Robinson. Explain for listeners what With Nolan I was about.
It's a film about two unemployed actors who are living in a decrepit, rundown flat in London, and it's set in the 60s. And they decide to get out of London and go to and go out to the country. And it's a brilliant piece of comedy that, for me, one of the ultimate buddy flicks, I guess, if
yeah.
you will.
And here's a clip from it with Richard E. Grant playing Withnall. and his buddy, only referred to as I, played by Paul McGann.
We can't go on like this. I'm a trained actor reduced to the status of a bum. Have you been at the controls?
What are you talking about?
The thermostats. What have you done to them?
I haven't touched them.
Then why has my head gone numb? I must have some booze. I demand to have some booze.
So Whitnall, the Richard E. Grant character, is Hulk, I guess?
Yeah. Richard E. Grant's character is, he has these swings. He is a kind of a kind of bipolar.
He would now be diagnosed. Style.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very much like Hulk or like Banner. He's prone to these tantrums and these huge mood swings. And I guess Thor is I.
Yeah. Another one of your influences for Thor is Flash Gordon, which was a 1980 movie adaptation directed by Mike Hodges, which didn't take itself seriously at all and had a memorable soundtrack.
I grew up with that and I loved that. That was quite a funny, camp and colorful, over-the-top film. And I have always said that if Freddie Mercury were alive today, I would have asked Queen to do the soundtrack.
And Queen did the soundtrack.
They did.
Of Flash Gordon. Your movie Thor has very prominently one of the cheesiest Led Zeppelin songs used to great effect. It's Immigrant Song from Led Zeppelin III, released before you were born.
They're all pretty cheesy, let's be honest.
Yes.
You can't say one. You can't say the cheesiest.
True. I guess that's
You can't talk about Led Zeppelin without... Let me remind you, all of their songs are about The Hobbit and Vikings.
Yeah.
The lyrics of that song, we come from the land of the ice and snow. It deserves to be in this movie.
That's true. Another film you say was an influence of yours is a movie I have not seen, 1973, The Holy Mountain, directed by Alejandro
Jodorowsky.
Thank you. Which is about a Christ-like figure seeking enlightenment.
Each stone has a soul formed by the work of millions of years. The tarot will teach you how to create a soul.
Visually, it's a stunning film.
And surreal.
Very surreal. It's, I've never understood what went on in the film. He does these very interesting shots, which I've kind of, I think I've been inspired by for this film.
So in this film, Thor, your major villain, Grand Master, is beautifully played by Jeff Goldblum. I don't know if that was your casting or the studio's casting, but nicely done.
Yeah. He's doing a great Jeff Goldblum impersonation, isn't he?
Oh, listen to that. He's threatening me. Hey, Sparkles, here's the deal. If you want to get back to Asberg.
Asgard!
Any contender who defeats my champion, their freedom they shall win.
Fine, then point me in the direction of whoever's ass I have to kick.
That's what I call contender.
Chris Hemsworth, who has already played Thor a few times, I really had no idea he could do comedy. This well.
Yeah, well, you got to see Ghostbusters, the new one.
What's this place called again?
Conductors of the Metaphysical Examination.
Got it. Conductors of Metamucils and stuff. Let's slow down.
They hung up?
No, I was just not into that conversation.
He steals a lot of scenes and when he's not the main actor.
When I think of funny New Zealanders or... for that matter, any New Zealanders, I think of your friend Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, and now you. And so now I feel like I know the difference between New Zealanders and Australians. You're these skinny guys with beards and Chris Hemsworth.
Muscly.
Yeah, and those guys are just like super Southern Californians.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Okay. Good. I'm glad I was.
I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to go. I know what's happening. You want to set me off. You want to turn me into the Hulk. but Chris is legitimately funny.
Yeah. Well done. You made this old geezer like a superhero movie very much. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thor Ragnarok, directed by Taika Waititi, is now playing everywhere on Earth. Coming up, why nobody cares what kind of kicks Emily Dickinson wore.
Something that hip-hop has been able to achieve that poetry has not quite is that hip-hop is a totalizing culture. So hip-hop is not only a musical practice, right, but it's a sartorial practice, it's a verbal practice.
Poet Eve Ewing, she's next in Studio 360.
Studio 360.
Eve Ewing's terrific new book is called Electric Arches, and it's shelved in the poetry sections of bookstores. But like Eve Ewing, it's not easy to categorize. She is a poet, and the book contains lots of poems, but it also has illustrations by her and some short stories and pieces of shrewd social criticism. It's really a one-of-a-kind feast of a book. Eve Ewing is also a Twitter star and earns her living as a sociologist at the University of Chicago. In other words, Eve Ewing, Renaissance person. I asked her to read some of her poems, including this one called Columbus Hospital, which is where she was born in Chicago 30 years ago and which no longer exists.
Columbus Hospital. The first stone is the hardest. Which is why they don't use hands anymore. Too much. The push of the granite on the pads of the fingers. Too much like the push of a match on the side of the dollar store box when the phosphorus has all gone out of it. The tinder has all gone out of its heart. And the red is scratched with brown, such that you rub and scrape, but the fire never comes. It hurts too much, that fruitless scrape. So they don't use their hands anymore. No, the croaking chain does a man's job. Wrecking balls don't get arthritis or cry or show up on site with lunches that their wives made, bleary-eyed, standing in worn house coats in the darkness. The dynamite never says, but my uncle died here in this hospital, and I still smell the ammonia and see the misshapen pound cake. While the tremor spreads and the walls come down. It's a depressing-ass poem. Sorry, guys.
It's no. And I was just going to say, in my opinion, which should not be regarded as expert on poetry, you're a really good poet.
Thank you. I truly appreciate that. Well, I truly appreciate that.
That's what I feel. This book, and obviously you, but this book is so grounded in Chicago with these references to these specific streets, intersections, stores. Because why?
Well, because that's where I'm from. I think that part of the human condition is that I think we're attracted to specificity of narrative because we're able to fill in our own story, right? So, like, a lot of my favorite writers and authors and musicians are talking about places where I've never lived, in some cases, places where I've never even been, right? But there's something so magical about somebody's ability to accurately describe a place and a set of people. And that's something I've always been inspired by and something I'm striving for here. And I have a poem in the book called Fullerton Avenue. And 99% of the people who read the book like don't know where that is and have never been there. And I think that they can still get a lot out of the poem. But then there's that 1% of people that are like, you know, I know the laundromat that you're talking about. And that's great for them as well. So I hope it kind of operates on different valences.
So that poem was grounded in reality, very much so. But others in the book are more fantastical and almost sci-fi. Do you have influences in those genres?
I used to watch a lot of Twilight Zone as a kid.
Good for you.
Yeah, I'm a big, huge fan of the Twilight Zone. I'm a big fan of like Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Wars, which sort of, I guess, straddles a line between sci-fi and fantasy. Read a lot of fantasy as a kid. And so, yeah, those are absolutely influences of mine. And I think that
I enjoy the blurriness of boundaries between our contemporary reality and the sense of possibility that those genres provide. But I think sci-fi more generally is a place where we kind of work out our cultural tensions in a way that fascinates me.
Which leads me to a question I've had about the term Afrofuturism, which has become very...
All of a sudden is like everywhere.
Yes.
I wrote the book at the right time.
And I think I may have first heard of it when Janelle Monáe was on the show like a decade ago.
Wow, I didn't know Janelle Monáe was on the show. She's a huge influence on this book, actually, and on me.
I can imagine.
Yeah, you can see some probably fairly obvious ways that that's the
case. But other than Black people writing science fiction, what does Afrofuturism mean to you?
The way I always define it is the simple premise that Black people are going to continue to exist into the future. And then once you take that basic premise, you can work through all the implications of how and why and what that means. And it's a premise that on the one hand, the simplicity is deceptive because when you are from a diasporic people who have at every different stage in history, especially throughout American history, faced the essential threat of annihilation, then the premise that you continue to exist is actually kind of radical. It's also radical in the context of a science fiction culture in which Black people often are completely absent. People of color often are completely absent. So both within kind of the literary or popular culture tradition and then on this fundamental premise, to me, it's actually kind of a radical, fascinating idea.
So it's not necessarily, I'm from Planet Kobob.
No, although I am from Planet Kobob and I don't appreciate being outed on air.
Oh, sorry. No. I apologize.
No, it's okay.
The pop singer, Janelle Monáe, how do she and her fictional alter ego fit into this?
So Cindy Mayweather, Janelle Monáe's character, is a great example of this, right? Cindy Mayweather is this character who is an android who has these kind of messianic... legacy or destiny, right? And the ways in which robots and cyborgs and androids are treated in this fictional universe that she's created in many ways mirrors the ways in which Black people are treated in the contemporary moment, right? In the same way that like the X-Men have for generations been using the idea of a mutant as sort of like a stand-in for racism, right? So there's this like bias and bigotry and fear, xenophobia against mutants. And then you have people like Sun Ra who say, like, no, I'm actually from a different planet. And part of what I'm looking for as a Black person is a chance to escape in oppression, which is then located not only in this country, but actually in the entire condition of being on Earth. And I'm trying to get back to my homeland, right? So I think that if you take that simple premise, it allows you to play out the ramifications in all of these different ways that fascinate me.
Will you read another poem now?
Sure.
What I mean when I say I'm sharpening my oyster.
Oh, sure. I love that poem. So this poem is inspired by a quotation from Zora Neale Hurston, the great Harlem Renaissance writer, who said, "No, I do not weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife." This poem is called What I Mean When I Say I'm Sharpening My Oyster Knife. I mean, I'm here to eat up all the ocean you thought was yours. I mean, I brought my own quarter of a lemon, tart and full of seeds. I mean, I'm a tart. I'm a bad seed. I'm a red-handled thing, and if you move your eyes from me, I'll cut the tender place where your fingers meet. I mean, I never met a dish of horseradish I didn't like. I mean, you're a twisted and ugly root, and I am the pungent, stinging firmness inside. I mean, I look so good in this hat with a feather, and I'm a feather, and I'm the heaviest featherweight you know. I mean, you can't spell anything I talk about with that sorry alphabet you have left over from yesterday. I mean, when I see something dull and uneven, barnacled and ruined, I know how to get to its iridescent everything. I mean, I eat them alive. What I mean is, I'll eat you alive, slipping the blade in sideways, cutting nothing, because the space was always there.
That's Eve Ewing reading her great poem, reading it as an entirely different character than the previous one you read.
Yeah, they're very different. The poem is very much inspired by, like, battle rap and hip-hop. And Zora Neale Hurston is this kind of defiant character. And so I hope to bring some of that defiance into the piece.
You seem like maybe the Hurston of your generation, right? I mean, you don't.
Oh my gosh!
You
thanks.
Don't stick to one lane. She didn't stick to one lane. In addition to being a novelist, her most famous novel being "Their Eyes Were Watching God," she was an anthropologist.
Yes, I tell people that all the time.
Right? Researched African American and Haitian folklore
yes,
and
yes.
religion. She must be a big, huge role model for you.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Yes, very much so. I mean, well, as somebody who is a social scientist and also a creative writer, people ask me all the time, you know, how do you do both of these things, or what does it mean, or how do you move between them? And that's a little frustrating for me because I feel like people don't realize that there are historical antecedents. Hurston is an example that I often give. So is Du Bois. W.E.B. Du Bois is another example that I often give.
He was a sociologist.
He was a sociologist. He made visual art. He wrote novels. He was an
essayist. Started the NAACP.
Yeah, he did all of the things. And so I think that it is so much less necessary than people assume to draw these strict boundaries around your own work. And it just seems so artificial.
Well, and 200 years ago, it wasn't nearly as true.
No. And, you know, I say that all the time when, like, people are talking about, like, oh, well, are you a spoken word poet or a literary poet? I'm like, well, was Homer a spoken word poet, or was he, you know, what do those things even mean? But yeah, Zora Neale Hurston is a huge influence on me in that regard.
You mentioned that poem was also inspired by hip-hop. Have the last couple of generations of battle rap and hip-hop and spoken word softened up the ground for people's ability to get poetry, do you think?
I think that for some people, that, like, a familiarity with hip-hop and with the verbal necessities of hip-hop can provide an entryway into other conversations about poetry.
It's a gateway form.
I think so. But like any gateway, you kind of have to walk through, right? So I'll give you an example. Like, a generation ago, a lot of folks in hip-hop were drawing very, very heavily from jazz music, right? In a way that I think now a lot of my contemporaries are drawing very heavily from funk music. But it's not like everybody who listened to Mos Def then went on to become like a hardcore jazz fan, right? But I'm sure some people did. So I think that, like, I think that all of these art forms have very fluid relationships across the cultural landscape, and the choice is there for people as to how they may or may not use one to sort of slide into the other. And I'm not really mad at it either way. I think that there are people who...
That was a very diplomatic way of saying poetry is superior to hip-hop.
Not at all. Quite the contrary. I mean, the idea of being able to establish a hierarchy is a little bit countervalent to the whole notion of art.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like if you ask, you know, what's more fun, riding a bicycle or baking a cake? I mean, they're just in totally different universes. Of course, that those analogies don't quite work because I don't think hip hop and poetry are in totally different universes. I think that they draw on similar vocabularies. And I, of course, don't just mean word vocabularies, but vocabularies of the body, vocabularies of verse and meter and rhyme and craft.
And each can achieve things that the other simply can't.
Absolutely.
And then one can make the decision like, well, the achievement here is simply superior to the maximum achievement here. Those are not invalid judgments.
I mean, Chance the Rapper is, you know, one of the most important and influential people in hip hop right now. And he was reared in the same poetry culture that I was, you know.
You are such a Chicago partisan.
It's true. I can't help myself. But I also think something that hip hop has been able to achieve that poetry has not quite, although I could see it going in this direction, is that hip hop is a totalizing culture. So hip hop is not only a musical practice, right? But it's a sartorial practice. It's a verbal practice.
A branding practice.
It's all of the above, right?
Imagine if poetry were that. That would be terrifying.
It's hard for me to even conceptualize what that would look like, but I don't think it's impossible, actually.
You are also a Twitterific person.
Thanks.
And in fact, before I saw this book, I was aware of you on Twitter and your nom de Twitter, Wikipedia Brown.
Thanks, yeah. Not my real name.
So do you see it as a writing venue for throwaway things, as a distraction like smoking cigarettes used to be, as a place to get news? What is it for you mainly?
For me, it serves a lot of purposes. One is that I am a big believer in concision, and I'm not someone who necessarily tends toward concision naturally. I'm kind of an overly verbose person. So I think it's actually a really great tool to push oneself to argue things really succinctly. I really appreciate that. Another thing for me, Twitter is very much still a social network. It allows me to engage with people that have very niche interests. I always used to explain to people that social networks on Facebook are proximal in real life, but heterogeneous, and social networks on Twitter are distant in real life, but homogenous.
Well said, sociologist.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I should put that in a paper or something. So, you know, on Facebook, you have like the people you went to high school with and that guy you met that one time at that cocktail party that you sort of had a conversation with.
Or people who you just want to buy your book who are total strangers.
Right. And they have all these different opinions and ideas, and you can have a conversation on one level with those folks, right? And on Twitter, you might be talking to people that you have never met in person and will never meet, but the conversation you can have with them can drill down much deeper because it's a much more homogenous conversation, right? So, you know,
because it's entirely opt-in, you create this silo.
And I think that people often talk about that in terms of like political ideologies and the implications of that. But I think about it, for me, the way it's most relevant is in terms of like pop culture. And so, you know, I could go on Facebook and be like, okay, you know, has anyone seen the latest Star Wars trailer? And I can go on Twitter and have that same conversation. And it's a whole bunch of like black nerds that are roughly the same age as me from all over the country or all over the world arguing about what it means to have a black stormtrooper, right? And that is so delicious and delightful for me that I just really enjoy it.
So black Twitter is a thing. Obviously, there are many black Twitters because your nerd version is different than somebody else's.
I think black Twitter is a thing. My good friend Van Newkirk, who I met on Twitter, and now he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. But anyway, Van has made the argument for a while that black Twitter is Twitter. And I think that increasingly has become the case.
Meaning
that in the same ways that African-American people in this country have become drivers of popular culture in so many other arenas, in ways that are often sometimes made visible, like with, for example, hip hop and sports, and other times kind of erased, like, for example, rock and roll music, that the most influential people who are driving the most interesting conversations on Twitter that are most visible are black people. And that trends and memes and conversations and shifts and politics are sort of driven by that group of people.
I'd like to see the scholarship on that. I'm not sure I'd buy that.
Well, I think that it depends on what you mean in terms of like people who are relatively few in number who have a very outsized influence on a conversation.
Punching above weight, I would definitely accept. E-viewing, I could talk to you all day. This has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Electric Arches, your book, is out now and available everywhere.
Everywhere.
Here is this guy performing at one of his campaign rallies last year.
And I'll tell you what, folks, you heard me the other night. I wasn't thinking even about you. I'm thinking about the miners all over this country. We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to put the miners back to work.
And then this guy, also in 2016, also performing a role as a character campaigning for president in West Virginia.
Gotta love coal. I know you guys have suffered terribly, worse than anyone, and as president, I promise, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you people work in coal for the rest of your lives.
Alec Baldwin has been channeling Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live since last fall, and earlier this year, he recruited me to collaborate with him on a project writing Trump's fictional first-year presidential memoir, which is just out. It is called You Can't Spell America Without Me. Alec Baldwin, welcome back to Studio 360.
You know, I'm dumb, but I'm no dummy. You know what I'm saying? That's why I hired you. I knew what I needed.
Yeah. We're going to get on to talk about things other than us and doing Trump, but as I was doing it with you, one of the most delightful parts was of doing this thing, You Can't Spell America, was when we'd talk about what Trump might say here, what Trump might do there, you really naturally fall into Donald Trumpism. I mean, it's like it's almost automatic.
When you do Trump and you play it week after week after week, I'll be talking to somebody, and it is bizarre how not a lot, I mean, you don't make a habit of this, you just erupt into this thing. Like, you'll look at somebody and go, I'd like to have the roasted chicken, please. Very well done. Very well done. I want you to roast the shit out of that chicken. You know, and you just burst into that.
Yeah.
It's weird.
By the way, here is a bit that I had not heard until today, a bit from the book of you, the audio version of the book of you as the president.
I wanted to say to the blacks, work will set you free. work will set you free. Make it a new Trump chant, like lock her up, but positive, like America first. And I said to my team when they got so upset, hey, I'm a very strong believer in hard work. I don't know German. I don't know free fatty Arbuckle or whatever you say it is in German. I never knew German, only my dad, Sieg ist mein, and a few others, but very, very few of the African Americans would know the concentration camp slogan anyway, I'm sure, because I didn't.
Alec Baldwin as President Trump in the audio version of our book.
Free Fatty Arbuckle.
It also struck me, thinking about you doing Trump, that while you have done all kinds of characters in film and on TV and stage, some of the greatest and most memorable are these jerks that you've done.
Villains.
Right? Villains of this very American male kind. It's almost like you were preparing for this,
this
your destiny
as been a lead up.
The president.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of the magnificent role you had as the character Blake in David Mamet's movie adaptation of his play, Glengarry Glen Ross, 1992. Here's a clip.
Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only. You think I'm fucking with you? I am not fucking with you. I'm here from downtown. I'm here from Mitch and Murray. And I'm here on a mission of mercy.
How awful.
How awful?
How awful. Well, you know what I love is that I spoke to Mamet, you know, around the time preparing to do the film, and Mamet said, none of these men are criminals, and they're going to commit a criminal act, and I need this deus ex machina to come in and instigate and to force them to commit a criminal act. In the play—
He doesn't exist.
Well, but he's, and it was funny how he said, you know, in the play, which won the Pulitzer Prize, he thought there was something missing. So he decides to go and rewrite his Pulitzer Prize-winning play for the movie. He said, I really felt there was a guy that needed to kind of lean on them. So he created the character of Blake. Mamet writes about predation in the human world. I mean, this is predation. You see in Glengarry, and you see in Oleana, and you see the way people behave that are the real tough dramas. It's ugly.
You played a fabulous jerk boss for 7 years on television, the NBC executive Jack Donaghy on 30 Rock. Here is a clip from early in the show, early in his relationship with Liz Lemon, Tina Fey's character.
Are you familiar with the GE Trivection oven?
I don't cook very much.
Sure. I got you. New York, third wave feminist, college educated, single and pretending to be happy about it, overscheduled, undersexed. You buy any magazine that says healthy body image on the cover, and every 2 years you take up knitting for a week.
That is dead on.
What, are you going to guess my weight now?
You don't want me to do that.
That was season one.
Yeah,
as you
exactly.
can tell. Yeah, but I don't think he was a jerk.
You don't?
I never thought, no, I thought he was just very clear. And I thought he was very clear.
He was that. Rewatching him last week, preparing for this, I thought, oh, a younger, much smarter, much more focused version of Donald Trump.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
don't think so.
But
I'm glad you think so. I'm glad it triggered some.
You love Jack, I guess.
I love Jack. Well, I think that Trump is malicious. I don't think Jack was malicious. And whenever the malice crept into the script, we took it out of
Trump
there.
Is in a drama. Jack was in a comedy.
Okay. I learned something today.
There you go. Then and now you have incarnated a new jerky boss in your franchise as a baby, boss baby. Here's a clip.
Oh, no. Yeah. I know what you're thinking. Look how helpless he is. Can't even change his own diaper. Well, can't or won't. Diapers are all about power dynamics. I poop, they wipe, bam! I'm the boss. That movie made $500 million worldwide, I'll have you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's in another
level.
So
you got 100, 200 of that?
about 175 of it. I mean, it's in another level from Trump and Donaghy and all that stuff. Yeah, that was huge.
You said it in the normal, almost in the normal Alec Baldwin voice. So, thinking about the great jerks and villains of cinema, I asked you for a list of performances that you admire, and because of your encyclopedic knowledge of the cinema, you gave about 24, and we're going to talk about a few in what I'm calling Baldwin movie classics. It'll be a franchise for us. Louise Fletcher as Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Here's to remind our listeners.
Hard on. Thank you. Excuse me, miss. Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
That music is for everyone, Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah, I know, but you think we might ease it down a little bit so maybe the boys didn't have to shout? Huh?
What you probably don't realize is that we have a lot of old men on this ward who couldn't hear the music if we turned it lower. That music is all they have.
With Jack Nicholson, of course, as McMurphy. And there, I love the Louise Fletcher as Ratchet because she's being nice.
Yeah. I try to think of women as villains when we talked about this, and that Louise Fletcher character, oh, my God, it's maddening what she does to him.
Yeah. And I met her subsequently. She's a lovely person. Yeah. And it was, but it was a little like, are you going to scare me, you know, when I met her in Hawaii?
I know. It's like it's like Ted Levine, the actor that played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
I'd seen Silence of the Lambs. I think I was in my hotel, and I watched it a couple of nights in a row on the hotel pay-per-view, and I was just so flooded with the images from that movie. Then I went to work shooting the movie Prelude to a Kiss in Chicago with Meg Ryan, and the local Chicago makeup artist, her husband came to work one day to visit her, and it was Ted Levine, the actor that played. Huh. And I thought my skin was going to just burst into flames.
There you go. Even people in the business aren't immune from that feeling. Here now is Nicholson as another of your favorites a few years later as the novelist at work being interrupted by his wife in this scene played by Shelley Duvall in The Shining.
Wendy, let me explain something to you. Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me. And it will then take me time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
Fine. And we're gonna make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the fuck you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. How do you think you can handle that?
So great.
Right? You know, it's funny how to do a good role, the phrase I was always told so you can avoid the judgment, the villainy
right. And
jerks and things like that. Someone said, you're the negative value in the piece. Don't think about it. You're there. You're going to play Hitler. That's the old cliche. You're going to play Hitler. You got to give it everything you've got. Yeah. You got to be the best Hitler you can be. You're going to play.
They don't think they're villains.
No, they think they're on to something. Yeah. So movies I've played, I thought, well, you want the audience to be excited when that guy expires, when the hero or heroine dispenses with them. And just for the satisfaction of the audience, I mean, no one was more, I'm not going to say mustache twirling, but no one was fuller in their villainy. No one was more soaring in their kind of villainy than Nicholson in that movie.
Well,
it was incredible.
The last 15 minutes, especially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But even up to them, even when he's warming up to it. Yeah, that movie, just to me, is a work of art. I love that movie.
Another one you named, and I wouldn't have thought of this because, of course, you think of Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch. To Kill a Mockingbird, the actor James Anderson as Bob Yule. Here he is.
Yeah, here we go.
Mr. Yule? Captain, I'm real sorry they picked you to defend a nigger that raped Mama Yeller. I don't know why I didn't kill him myself instead of going to the sheriff. Well, it saved you and the sheriff and the taxpayers lots of trouble.
Excuse me, Mr. Yule, I'm very busy.
Hey, Captain, somebody told me just now that they thought that you believed Tom Robinson's story again, Iron.
Again, Iron.
You know what I said? I said you wrong, man. You dead wrong. Miss Finch ain't taking this story against Iron. Well, they was wrong, wasn't it?
I've been appointed to defend Tom Robinson. Now that he's been charged, that's what I intend to do.
You've taken his story.
Excuse me, Mr. Ewell.
What kind of man are you? You got children of your own.
You got children of your own, he says.
And you were reciting it, which is a beautiful thing to watch. And I loved how, in the writing, I guess it was in the writing, he said, Captain. Hey, Captain.
Yeah, again on. He says, you're going to take the word of it. You're going to take Tom Robinson again on. He says, that guy, he died early. He was only 48 years old, I believe. He was a very young guy. But he gives one of the greatest performances. I mean, there's so many great performances, obviously, in this film. Mary Badham and Duvall, who doesn't even have a line, and he just crushes you with his acting as Boo Radley. His film debut, Duvall's film debut. But this character of Bob Yule is just one of the worst characters, the most despicable characters.
And he does it so realistically. There's nothing, I mean, that you really think that guy is that guy.
He doesn't back off from it at all. It's thrilling.
Yeah. We can end on a more cheerful note. This is from the producers, your suggestion of the wonderful Zero Mostel as Bialystok. Here he is near the beginning of the film, asking Gene Wilder, as his accountant Bloom, to save him from his malfeasance.
Mr. Bialystok, I've discovered a serious error here in the accounts of your last play.
Well, what?
Well, according to the backers list, you raised $60,000, but the play that you produced only cost $58,000. That's $2,000 unaccounted for.
I went to a Turkish bath. Who cares? The play was a flop. What difference does it make?
What difference does it make? That's fraud. If they found out, you could go to prison.
Who's going
to
find out it's only $2,000? Bloom, do me a favor. Move a few decimal points around. You can do it. You're an accountant. You're in a noble profession. The word count is part of your title.
That's cheating.
It's not cheating. It's charity. Bloom, look at me. Look at me, Bloom. Bloom, I'm drowning. Other men sail through life. Bialystok has struck a reef. Bloom, I'm going under. I am being sung by a society that demands success when all I can offer is failure. Bloom.
Bloom.
I'm reaching out to you. Don't send me to prison.
Like Jack, he's a lovable reprobate.
Lovable. Right? There's no one more lovable than him. But are we going to do honorable mention of all the other ones? We're not going to do the
Sure, go ahead. Well, I just want to mention
James Mason in The Verdict.
You're not paid to do your best. You're paid to win.
One of the great scenes.
Against
scene.
Paul Newman.
Against Paul Newman. That scene where he puts the check in Charlotte Rampling's pocketbook. He pays these legal fees that pay for my whiskeys, my darling. Jack Palance and Shane.
Stonewall Jackson was trash himself. Him, Lee, and all the rest of them ribs. You too.
The ending, oh, man.
As the horrible guy who comes to town and...
Yeah, when he kills Alicia Cook, we're going to come back to...
For being a dirty rat.
When he says, yo, you rib, Jackson Lee, they're trash. You trash too, he says. Blows him away. Jack Palance, great, great. Lee Ermey. In Full Metal Jacket, the guy that was the drill sergeant.
What is your major malfunction, numbnuts?
Wonderful performance. Lee J. Cobb and On the Waterfront. Lee J. Cobb
as the Union Boss.
As the Union Boss.
We got the fattest piers and the fattest harbor in the world. Everything moves in and out. We take our cut.
He's like, you know, just a lesson in acting. Because a guy that rides the perfect blend of like the kind of forceful and the brutish and the charming and the kind of black-sapping Paul he is. Otto Preminger in Stalag 17.
Well, there'll be two SS men here tomorrow to take you to Berlin.
He's a full-scale Nazi commandant.
Exactly. I think he really did have a lot of wiggle room there, you know what I mean? To kind of
don't think of him as bad. He's negative space.
He's the greatest Nazi commandant, the most charming. And of course, Alicia Cook in Maltese Falcon. I love Alicia Cook.
Keep on riding me. They're going to be picking iron out of your liver.
My favorite line Bogart's is when he disarms him. You know, like he pulls his coat over
his
head.
He's the bad guy and kills an old lady.
And he's the henchman. Yeah. And then Bogart takes the gun away from him. Bogart says, my favorite line goes, that's going to get you in real good with your boss, he says.
Come on, this will put you in solid with your boss.
You are a connoisseur of this.
I love those kinds of movies.
Yeah.
That's why I do a lot of my stuff on TCM.
Alec, thank you.
Hey, listen, I want everybody to know you did a great job on the book. You're going to get a lot of great response for that. It's funny.
And there are dozens of hilarious pictures of you as our president in various realistic-looking presidential spaces. You Can't Spell America Without Me, it's called. The really tremendous inside story of my fantastic first year as President Donald J. Trump. It's out. It's been a pleasure doing that and talking to you here today.
And we got other plans up our sleeve, too, don't we?
Eh, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Right after Alec Baldwin left the studio, he called me in a dither because he'd forgotten one of his favorite cinematic villains of all time and wanted to make sure I said it. That is Robert Newton, especially for his performance as Bill Sykes in Oliver Twist, David Lean's 1948 version.
Ill-treating the boys again, eh? You avaricious old fence.
And that's it for this week's episode. Studio 360 is a production of PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Zoe Saunders,
Tommy Bazarian.
Our production assistant is
Claude Gallette.
And I am Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening. Donaghy or Donaghy?
Donaghy.
Donaghy, right?
Donaghy.
Oh, like the Indian clarified butter. Ghee.
Is it ghee?
PRI, Public Radio International.
80 years later, a song about the Roaring Twenties seems absolutely relevant.
You better accept the fact that anything's gonna go because that's what America's about. You might as well enjoy the ride.
Anything Goes. That's our next American icon in Studio 360 from Public Radio International in association with Slate.
Anything goes. Good offers too. Who wants new better words?